In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about malaria. Malaria is a disease that is one of the world's most common and serious tropical diseases. It's also one of the world's great killers. It kills more than 1 million people a year. Malaria is a disease that is both treatable and preventable, and in fact, malaria has been eradicated from many developed countries. It does, however, continue to be a major health problem in countries where poverty prevents access to effective treatment. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll be talking about malaria, talk a little bit about the basics of the disease, what it is, how it works, also talk a little bit about treatment and prevention, and talk about some of the progress that has been made recently toward developing a vaccine. And our guest for the program is Dr. Robert Desiewicz. He's an expert on tropical disease. He is both a fellow of the American Society of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene and the Royal Society of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene. He's done research in a number of countries, Nigeria, Singapore, Thailand, Hawaii. He's member of the World Health Organization's Expert Committee on Parasitic Diseases and has served as consultant to a number of governments, including Burma, Fiji, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, India, Tonga. He's written a number of books about tropical disease. Just one I want to mention specifically deals with the subject we're talking about here this morning, and that is a book entitled The Malaria Capers, More Tales of Parasites and People, Research and Reality. That book was published by W.W. Norton in 1991. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The only things that we ask of people calling into the program is that they're just try to be brief in their comments. And we ask that so that we can keep the program moving along, get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to join the conversation. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, you certainly should feel welcome to pick up the telephone and join in. Dr. Desiewicz, hello.
Good morning. Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
We certainly appreciate it. Just overall, I'm sure that we can try and hit all the basics and talk about the things that I mentioned. And of course, part of the reason I think our interest in reviewing the topic was to talk a little bit about some of the recent news, relatively recent news, about progress toward a vaccine. But just as a way of starting, I wonder how it is that we assess where we are now with malaria, particularly because, as I said, on the one hand, there are places, countries that are in temperate climates where you would expect there might be malaria, where essentially it's been eliminated. And yet, on the other hand, there are other places, and we are talking about the developing world. I think, in fact, the vast majority of cases of malaria are in Africa, and most of them are in children. And we would have to say that because we know we should be able to prevent and deal with that, and it shouldn't be that kind of a problem. So I guess how is it we look at the progress or maybe in some cases lack of progress in dealing with this disease?
It's really a lack of progress, and I think we were probably better off almost 50 years ago. Malaria has never really been touched in Africa, where the great repository is. And it has come back in high numbers, high morbidity and mortality, back to Southeast Asia, where there is drug resistance, insecticide resistance, people resistance. And it's a kind of a frightening situation again after being suppressed or under control in many parts of the world for a long time. You know, we even had a mini outbreak in Palm Beach, I think it was last year sometime. Mosquitoes are still around.
Well, it is true, and people also ought to know, and if they don't, that malaria, certainly there was a time when malaria was a serious problem in the United States. And as you mentioned, pretty much it's not something we worry about anymore, although I believe that some figures I have here for 2002 say that there were something over 1,300 cases of the disease reported in the United States 2002, including 8 people who died. So that even though since the early 50s, at least on paper, we say that malaria was eradicated, has been eradicated in the United States.
It's mostly in travelers. But again, it was the American disease. It had bled the South white. We built this house. We came from Hawaii here, and our first visitor that summer was Mrs. Quadrimaculatus, the Anopheles mosquito that carried most of the malaria here through the United States. But it was probably one of the most serious problems all the way up. It's not a tropical disease. Hmm. We've had it all the way up through Maine at one point.
Why, I guess now your response, invites this question. Why is it that we actually seem to have taken some steps backward in dealing with malaria? It, in part, I suppose, is that somehow we should expect things like eventually disease-causing organisms will become resistant to the treatments we have, and insecticides, we will get to the point where insecticides won't work anymore. Is that just something that we should expect?
Well, I always thought that the brainless creatures that I deal with somehow get to be smarter than all the PhDs and the MDs and everything else. They're really cunning little creatures. The truth is we've always had methods to deal with malaria if one could apply them. The cheap, quick fixes that we expected in the 50s are no longer available. The drugs that was the sheet anchor, like chloroquine, which you could cure somebody for 50 cents, now requires a more sophisticated drug that may cost $5. It's a kind of a moral comment that we're not willing to spend $5 to save a child's life. The quick fix, really, of the 50s was the application of DDT, and for a number of reasons, presumably we'll get to it later on, that has been mostly closed to us now. We just don't have the armamentarium, the cheap, quick armamentarium that we had 50 years ago.
We do. I'll tell you what, we have a couple of callers already. And rather than make these people wait, why don't we find out what's on their minds? And particularly, I have somebody here who's calling on a cell phone, so I want to get to them. That's line number one. Hello.
Oh, hello. I wanted to ask your caller, your visitor. I had a splenectomy when I was 10 years old. And I found out the hard way that I really shouldn't travel in malarial regions through a Peace Corps experience. I won't go into that. Mm-hmm. However, I was wondering, are the preventative drugs any better? Can I now safely travel?
Well, I would always take a chance. You're at special risk with the splenectomy for a more fulminant course of malaria. However, there are good. There are a number of prophylactic drugs in the States. Mefloquine is one, although it may drive you a little bit batty. That's better than malaria. There's a new one called Malarone that's available in the States. Even doxycycline taken daily for a short visit. Go for it. Don't let a splenectomy prevent you from traveling.
That's
my feeling about it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We'll go to another caller here in Belgium, nearby community, line number four. Hello.
Good morning, all. I have a couple of questions. Number one, was malaria indigenous to the New World, or was it strictly just an African disease?
My take on it is that it was not indigenous to the New World. We had the vectors here. We had the special mosquitoes that could carry it. And it was brought in, I think, by the slave trade and the explorers, probably the European explorers, because Europe was highly malarious, particularly through Spain and Italy. So the consensus is that there was no pre-Columbian malaria in the New World. There are some people who found malaria in very deep jungle tribes somewhere in the Amazon, and they think that this is proof. This is malaria and syphilis are the big debaters. Were they here before Columbus's time? And my take on it is that it's purely imported into the New World.
Thank you. Another question, well, actually a comment. In the early diaries of people who first settled in Indianapolis, there was a serious malaria problem there when they first started growing the city, along with Washington, D.C., were very, very serious hotbeds of malaria at one point. And so it seems like when it came, it must have came like a vengeance. But the other question I really wanted to ask you about, and you haven't really talked about it yet too much, is the is what actually is the disease? And the reason I ask that is that it seems like malaria is almost a parasite in the way that it acts.
Well, it is. It certainly is the old definition as a parasite. To begin with, this is a 45-minute lecture. You know, all this is speaking 45-minute segments. But it's malarias rather than malaria. There are four species of malaria, and the one that is most fulminant and kills is falciparum. It usually is associated with higher temperatures. The other one that's fairly common is a Plasmodium vivax, and they call that a benign tertian. But I've had them both, and boy, you may almost die with falciparum, but you feel just awful with vivax, and that usually comes in the northern tiers during the spring and planting season. Then there's a malariae and an ovale, but we have four species, and we're susceptible to certain species that are in primates, that are in monkeys. And actually, there's been an outbreak in Malaysia just recently where the monkeys, they deforested the monkeys, came to the ground, and you got transmission to humans for the first time. So malaria is a parasite. They all have a fairly common life cycle in that they invade the red blood cells. That's the main cause of the anemia and the destruction as well. And the whole pathology. The symptoms are fever and rigor, but the kinds of symptoms can it's called the great mimic. You could have diarrhea, you could have all sorts of things that go wrong with it.
If I might ask one last question, is it always transferred through mosquitoes?
Yes and no. It is always through mosquito. It is through mosquitoes the main transmission. There is, of course, the possibility of it being with transfused blood, and occasionally it's a congenital where the newborn or the fetus, the late-stage fetus, gets it from the infected mother.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. Perhaps I should introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, Dr. Robert Desowitz. He's Emeritus Professor of Tropical Medicine and Medical Microbiology at University of Hawaii. That makes his home in North Carolina. He's done a lot of research and writing over the years about tropical disease. He's authored a book that's titled The Malaria Capers, More Tales of Parasites and People, Research and Reality, that was published by W.W. Norton in 1991. A little bit more recently, the book Who Gave Pinta to the Santa Maria, which is, again, an exploration of various tropical diseases, their origins and how they spread, syphilis being one of them. That's what the title refers to. That book, also published by Norton, W.W. Norton, that came out in 1997. Questions, again, are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. As you mentioned here, the basic, and I think maybe people will understand that indeed, malaria, the diseases that you're talking about are caused by parasites, and they are transmitted by mosquitoes, and not just any mosquito, but a particular kind of mosquito. And so one of the main tools, at least in the past, that was used to use insecticides, specifically DDT, and use that to try to get rid of the mosquitoes. So if you get rid of the mosquitoes, then you get rid of the disease because you don't have the means of transmissions. Then, of course, as people know, DDT was taken out of use because of concerns about its environmental impact. And obviously here there are trade-offs. Do you think that that was the correct decision? Should we have said, yes, maybe DDT has some environmental impact and it will not be good in some respects, but in other respects here, it's the best tool we have to fight the spread of this disease, so that perhaps we should say we should continue to use it, or we should have continued to use it at least some places?
It certainly must be used to control malaria. In itself, probably is not going to be the final answer. There's not one answer that fits all. DDT is the most powerful insecticide. It is unique. It is virtually non-toxic. There's going to be some debate about that, but we've just had a meeting of the National Academies of Sciences to reconsider its return. It has the properties of being residual. You spritz it on once inside a house, and it will have its insecticidal or repellent properties for up to 6-7 months. It is a great drug, and it is being used again there. When the chips are down in places like the epidemic in South Africa, back to DDT again. It's any number of places it's being used, and it was, again, dirt cheap. Environmentally, of the dead you speak nothing but good, but I'm afraid St. Rachel may well have, in her own way, have killed more people than destroyed ospreys, certainly. I'm sorry to be quite so strong about that, but it's become, again, a very impassioned topic, but it is coming back. The problem is big joke amongst us is that the only thing the malaria eradication scheme eradicated were the malariologists, and we just don't have quite the same knowledge where it should be strategically applied.
Is it also a fair criticism that some people make that it's another one of those cases where the people primarily affected by this disease are poor, they're people of color, they're people in the developing world, and that for that reason, when we look at understanding it and fighting it and preventing it, it gets a pretty low priority for that reason?
Well, I started work. I was American, but in the colonial service, the British colonial service, a real anomaly, in Nigeria. And the people, the colonials, the powers, were very compassionate people. If you had a sleeping sickness outbreak, you know, everything would, all the stops would be pulled out. Malaria had less attention because it was the perfect Malthusian instrument. It would cull the children and keep a steady population. But as you grew older, you develop a kind of clinical immunity, and you got an adult that was able to pursue the low technology agriculture, build roads, or act in service ways to the colonials in all sorts of ways. So in a way, it had less attention. And the colonialists, you know, the white settlers, the Europeans and the Americans, always had their quinine to at least save their lives. It's almost like malaria has always been sort of a morality play to me, and it's unique that way.
We have a number of calls now. In fact, the lines are full. We will get onto some other callers here, and I believe the next in line, again, someone on a cell phone calling from, I believe, in northern Illinois, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Good morning. You know, when I was in Vietnam, I took my malaria pill every day. When I came back to the States and went to give blood, they said they wouldn't take it from me. Do you know why that is?
Yes.
And they said it was because I'd been taking that pill.
No, it's not because you've been taking the pill. It may have been that, because the pill, the drug had long disappeared by that time. But there is the possibility. There is one kind of malaria, Plasmodium malariae, the Quartan one. And that lies sort of doggo in the blood. You become semi-immune to it. It could be as long as 50 years.
Wow.
And there is always the possibility of transfusion malaria. So they were erring on the very cautious side.
I thought we could never give blood then, huh?
You probably can't. I can't either.
Okay.
It's too bad.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to Champaign County. Call line number 1. Hello.
Hi. You didn't answer the question about racism very directly, but I think you illustrated it, actually. I don't want to be too confrontational, but I'm rather disgusted. You know, Malthus does not say that people die from malaria. People die from malaria because of all sorts of reasons. I mean, Hidden Hand of Malthus, I haven't heard that one in a while. And I respect your work over the years, but prescribing DDT for another country, you know, if you tried to do something spraying like that around here, I mean, it's when we had the West Nile, there were huge battles about spraying for mosquitoes in this area and other areas. I want to go back to the question I was going to ask because I'm
okay.
A little flustered about this.
The Malthus thing is true, actually. The attitudes.
Well, I'm sure it's. I don't deny the attitude, but I mean, you're rather cavalier about not condemning it. You just.
I said it was a morality play, and.
Oh, it's fine. It's fine for the colonial. You know, you were critical of them, saying they have the quinine, which is grown in the area from a bark of a tree in the area, and keep it to themselves, right? Okay, I'm looking for a little more outrage about it, but
okay,
I'm not afraid to say that. So, but anyway, what about a vaccination? That seems like a better place, a less ecologically damaging, and it's also affected by the same way. Since we're not suffering from it, the pharmaceutical industry isn't going to spend any money about it. But along with that, I have a story that's probably apocryphal, but a long time ago, a research assistant here told me that he worked under a fellow, and I believe the guy's name was Silverman.
Oh, yeah.
And he said that they had a remedy, a vaccination, and our strategy towards getting there, this was in the early 70s.
70s and 80s.
Well, you seem to know about the story, so I guess I'll finish my telling of
it
as the way I heard it. And then I'd like for you to just comment, you know, specifically on the idea of why, you know, spread polychlorinated hydrocarbons through the environment when you can vaccinate. But he told me that he had approached the Indian government, and Indira Gandhi was in, and he said that he would not, I guess this gets back to Malthus in a way, he would not proceed on the research and share it with Indian scientists unless she instituted some kind of major family planning procedure or, you know, policies.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you know anything about that specific story, but just it stuck with me all this time because, this is years and years ago, and it seems like if he had a glimmer of an idea, maybe he was totally wrong, and maybe the story's not right either, but why not a vaccination?
I don't know if we're into the vaccination segment.
Well, you can go. I mean, that is one of the questions that I want to talk about. So, we can go ahead and talk about that. Yeah.
Sure. All right. They have been pursuing a vaccine for 90 years now. And they are.
They're putting in. Obviously, nobody's doing it right, obviously.
There is no right. That's the problem. My belief is that we may have a short-term vaccine for soldiers fighting in some tropical country. It's as a military remedy, but the vaccine I think is being sold as a bill of goods right now. Vaccine that has just received such great press attention really doesn't work. It's not been effective, and there is a large body of malaria researchers who are rather appalled by the hype that it's being given and has been given. There is just no vaccine. There may well never be a vaccine, and it's not to obviate the other uses which are more difficult. The getting of proper chemotherapeutics, the getting of a proper insecticides, and impregnated mosquito nets into the population. We've spent hundreds of millions of dollars, and still the Gates Foundation, which has given with a generosity that has not been witnessed since the Rockefeller days, have been taken into this. And there's a group that feels very strongly that the vaccine pursuit may be doing more damage than it's doing good. But there is no vaccine.
You haven't illustrated any reason why it's theoretically impossible. You're just asserting it.
This is, again, one of my
45... You believe it strongly.
One of my 45 lectures. To begin with, we don't know really what causes the natural immunity or the semi-immunity that humans have. It's not like a bacterial. The other thing is that a bacteria is a bacteria is a bacteria. A malaria parasite is a sporozoite, a pre-erythrocytic schizont, an erythrocytic schizont, a merozoite. I go on.
Well, let me interrupt
stage,
because it is going over us here.
But is immunological.
Well, let's not call it a vaccine. Let's call it finding out what that natural immunity is and trying to find out a way of enhancing it. I mean, that's not a vaccination. That's not a, but it is an inoculation that would impart resistance. Now, that maybe is that a better formula of approach?
That may well be to reduce morbidity and mortality is probably a more realistic goal. We'll probably never have a a vaccine that confers a sterile immunity, as a bacterial or a viral vaccine will do. But the concern is that while there are other avenues, the great effort is being, hundreds of million dollars are being put into vaccine research. And this is not new. It's been going on for 90 years and will continue, possibly for another 90 years. So there are others who are prophetic and say it's the only game in town. And I'm sure the research will go forward, and we all wish them well.
We're a bit past our midpoint here. We have about 20 minutes left. We have some other callers waiting, and I do want to introduce again our guest, Robert Desowitz. He is Emeritus Professor of Tropical Medicine and Medical Microbiology at the University of Hawaii, and has done a lot of research over his life on tropical disease in countries including Nigeria, Singapore, Thailand, Hawaii. He is member of the World Health Organization Expert Committee on Parasitic Diseases, has served as consultant to a number of governments including Burma, Fiji, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Thailand, India, and Tonga. He has written a number of books, The Malaria Capers, More Tales of Parasites and People, Research and Reality, published by W.W. Norton in 1991, and then another book that deals in a more general way with a number of tropical diseases, that book, Who Gave Pinta to the Santa Maria, that was published by Norton in 1997, and is in part deals with the issue of syphilis and where it came from and how it was spread. That's what the title refers to. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. On again to another caller, and this time the caller is in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hi, yes, thank you.
Good morning.
I recently read about a pesticide Roundup. I don't know if you already talked about this before because I was tuning in, that humans can ingest. And it's actually non-toxic to humans because they don't have the metabolism to actually get to the toxic metabolites. And that this is effective against malaria, but that the research is being held up because of patent issues. I'm wondering if you know about this or...
No, I don't.
No?
No. I know there are a lot of patent issues.
You haven't heard about
it. I have no idea. I've not heard, but I'll certainly look into it. Curious, you know, it's like the pills we give to our cats for free.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks.
Sorry.
Well, does that? I mean, this may be a little bit out of your line, but does that seem like a reasonable avenue? It sounds as if the idea would be that the person would take in the insecticide. It would theoretically not harm them, but then if a mosquito bit them, then the mosquito would die as a result.
We do it for a lot of animals, including, as say, we just forced the pill down our cat's throat a couple of days ago. And these systemic insecticides seem to be effective. I would think the possible dangers and the lawsuits would be such that most developers would be very, very hesitant or reluctant to apply for that. That would be my take on it as well. What they're using mostly, or trying to use now, or trying to push forward, is mosquito nets that are impregnated with these long-lasting pyrethrum derivatives, pyrethroids, and they act as a repellent. And the claim is not everybody is agrees with it, but the claim is that where it's been used, they reduce malaria mortality by about 30-40%.
Let's talk with another caller. This is also someone in Urbana, line number 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Malaria has almost been written out of the local history. I was on another project and got involved with the memoir of a Dr. Charles Benulin Johnson, who practiced locally in Champaign County. He came here in 71, and his autobiography notes that in the summer of 72, the area, this region, experienced the last endemic, it's his word, of malarial fever in central Illinois. And he said, within the bounds of my practice, which was southern Champaign County, I think almost no one escaped an attack. And the other thread of this is the very important issue of drainage that the state legislature inadvertently in 1880, when they passed the drainage laws that enabled farmers to organize drainage districts and effectively lower the probably the water table in the, across the county about 10 feet, dried up all of these perennial swampy areas and so on, that that was the beginning of the end for malarial fevers here. And I just wanted to comment that it, on the one hand, until this county was, they began to settle it in the 1830s, and you have to see this disease as really a hindrance upon the occupation of this whole Grand Prairie region. And then after 1880, part of the energy that comes from the industrial developments, railroads and so on, must have been supplemented, augmented in some way by the fact that effectively drainage, although they didn't associate this with the mosquitoes that were causing the problems, enabled people to basically survive two or three bad months in late summer without, you know, healthier and more and with more strength and ability to do their ordinary task. And that was my comment, simply.
All right. Well, Dr. Deswitz, do you want to respond to that anyway?
Well, a couple peripheral ways, as usual. That's true. Malaria, the malaria mosquitoes, was distributed virtually all through the United States. In the northern tier, where Illinois, Indiana, that area, even in New York, you would most likely you would be getting Plasmodium vivax, which is very debilitating, but it doesn't cause any deaths. Nevertheless, it caused the anemia and the debilitation, and the malaria would be just at the spring planting season, so it had a tremendous amount of economic effect all through that part of the United States. It may even well have had some cognitive effect on the ability of children to learn. But you talk about the drying out. This is what the TVA scheme did in the Tennessee Valley. They were smart enough to lower the water levels. But the comment that we want to make is there are about 50 or 70 anopheline species that can act biologically as a malaria vector to carry malaria. And each one of those has a very specific and different kind of behavior, particularly in breeding and biting. Some will breed in wide open waters exclusively. Others will breed in very small collections of waters. So it's not one mosquito. It's many mosquitoes. And that's where you get, you have to have a strategy that deals with the mosquito vector within that particular endemic region.
Well, again, I hope that gets at the caller's question. We have about 15 minutes left. in this part of Focus 580. And again, our guest is Robert Deswitz. He is an expert on tropical disease. He's emeritus professor of tropical medicine and medical microbiology at University of Hawaii and has written on the subject, including his book published back in 1991, specifically about malaria. Our topic here, The Malaria Capers, More Tales of Parasites and People, Research and Reality, again published by Norton. Just to go back to the subject that we had a caller call in about, raising this question about whether it is possible that somehow a product could be developed similar to the kind of things that we give our cats and dogs, some kind of oral product that they can take that will fight off disease carrying insects. The caller made reference in her comments to Roundup, and one of our agricultural reporters, Todd Gleason, was listening, and he called to point out, first of all, quite correctly, that Roundup is a herbicide. It's a weed killer. It's not an insecticide. And he seems to be saying that, as far as he knows, that insecticides are very toxic and potentially harmful to human beings. And if you take in enough of them, if you ingest them, they will likely kill you. Herbicides not quite so problematic, but that wouldn't have the desired effect. So and maybe that's something we can investigate a little bit further. But we just wanted to put that information out there. Obviously, people should be very careful when handling these chemicals. Follow the directions and keep in mind the fact that they're potentially harmful.
Right.
Let us go here. We'll go to somebody else. Champagne line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, maybe I missed this discussion at the beginning of the hour when I wasn't listening. But what is the relationship between fighting malaria and the TB and the HIV virus? Have you discussed that yet? It seems like that's a very complicated issue, is it not?
This is not probably the common thought on this. I really don't think so.
Uh-huh.
For several reasons. But the main one, unlike TB and particularly the HIV, malaria is eminently treatable.
Uh-huh.
Nobody has to die of malaria. Now, the ability to buy the drugs, to get the drugs, to get pure drugs, you know, they have a wonderful drug now, which is originating mostly in China from the artemisinin, and that's being counterfeited. 90% of it that they found in Cambodia was counterfeit, but it's there. We could deal with malaria given if the affected countries were willing to overcome their administrative difficulties, their financial difficulties. But it's not like HIV and not like a good deal of tuberculosis, which is, again, drug resistance now. But the other thing is, of course, that makes malaria unique. It is transmitted by mosquitoes, specific mosquitoes. So you have two arms of attack, both in the human and against the mosquito vector as well.
Mm-hmm. So if someone is weakened by TB or HIV, that doesn't affect the progress of malaria?
It doesn't seem to, or there's a few studies from Africa that would indicate that they may that malaria may be a slightly more fulminant, but we're not seeing the overwhelming immune depression against malaria that we expected in the AIDS patients. We're beginning to see a little bit of malaria pregnancy in the HIV as being possibly more fulminant. You know, malaria not only kills children, usually under the age of five, but it's a disease of pregnancy, usually reasons that I'm not sure of, during the first pregnancy as well.
Well, you were saying that administrative and financial issues that are not properly managed cause malaria not to be addressed, how does that go along with problems with addressing issues of HIV and TB?
You have an attack. Probably in its simplest chemotherapeutic form, you have an attack of malaria, and you know it's malaria. You know, there's nothing quite like it, I think. And people go to their aid stations or the hospitals or even the local pharmacy, and they buy an effective therapy, and they take it in the prescribed fashion, and the attack is over.
Right.
Until the next time. With an HIV, you're taking thousands of dollars worth of drug that is trying to suppress it, but there's never any cure, so far at least. It's just a completely different thing.
And okay. Well, but I know that TB and HIV have been sort of associated as problematic. I guess I had thought that malaria was in that circle of issues. But
it's they call it the great neglected diseases because they're diseases right now where the large repository of it and the great difficulty is in the third world, particularly in Africa. So it's a kind of triad of death. But the approach to solving the problem of them is different, I think, for each one of those diseases. We just shouldn't lump them together.
Okay, well, that's very informative. Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. I've talked about the fact, and I think people often refer to malaria as being a tropical disease. And you said, well, it's not really a tropical disease, at least here in the United States. You said there was a time that it had been found as far north as Maine, which we don't particularly think of as tropical. Is there some concern, or do you think that there's reason for concern that if we have some of the climate change scenarios that some people are suggesting, where temperatures are going to warm, that we might see more problems with something like malaria here in the United States because there would be more territory that would be hospitable for the mosquitoes that carry the disease?
I don't think so. I think here in the United States, we would never allow the infection to get a foothold again. Our treatment network, our epidemiological network, is such that it would never get the foothold that it did in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Whether global warming will affect malaria is being debated. There's been several meetings on this. And what is certainly happening is that in the tropics, where the mountainous tropics, malaria is going up the mountain as climate changes and warms up. So there are communities peripherally that are now becoming under attack that hadn't been before. I don't know. Global warming, if it warms, you may get a temperature change sufficiently to get more of the Plasmodium falciparum, which is the fulminant kind of malaria and needs a higher temperature. So that would probably be the possible danger. I don't think the Western world should have any great fear of malaria and global warming. That's my take on it.
Just to touch once again for anybody who might not have been listening, because this was one of the reasons that we said we thought it would be interesting just to talk a little bit about, in basic terms, about the disease. Again, people might have heard, this was maybe back earlier in the fall, about there were some tests. There was a large vaccine trial in Africa that was funded by the Gates Foundation. It was the biggest trial that had ever been done. At least that's what it said in the stories that I had read, and that while it was not a complete success, there was some partial success. And the news on this was very optimistic, and you said you thought, well, perhaps it was a little bit too optimistic and that you were doubtful about the possibility that anytime soon there would be a vaccine, although you would expect that the research on the vaccine would continue, at least as long as there were people who were willing to fund it. Is it really the case? Is it fair to say that you don't ever expect to see a vaccine for malaria?
In my heart of hearts, I think I don't expect to see a vaccine, an effective vaccine that could be deployed to Africa. I think you may have a short-term vaccine that could be used in troops going to endemic areas for short periods. I think malaria is not one of those diseases like the common cold that's going to respond. But best of luck to them. You know, we all wish them well. And I was one of the early supporters of returning to vaccine research. And Paul Silverman was one of the first, back in 1972, convinced USAID, the United States Agency for International Development, to support his work. But we really don't have, and we don't have time to go into the numbers now and to the analyses. But there are some very distinguished malaria researchers who have re-examined the figures from Mozambique and feel that it was overstated. Mm.
Well, we will have to stop there because we've used our time. And Dr. Deswitz, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks much. I've enjoyed it.
Our guest, Robert Deswitz, Emeritus Professor of Tropical Medicine and Medical Microbiology at University of Hawaii, author of the book The Malaria Capers and also Who Gave Pinta to the Santa Maria, if you're interested in reading about the subject of tropical disease.